Hello and welcome to our podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom, not just information, not mere facts, to an audience of future leaders around the globe. In other words, we will be talking to interesting people with interesting experiences. My name is Siebe van der Zee, and I'm your host. I'm originally from the Netherlands, and I'm currently living in the state of Arizona in the United States of America, also known as the Dutchman in the desert. My company is involved in executive search and performance coaching. And oh yeah, in my career, I've had the opportunity to live in 4 countries on 3 continents. This podcast is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, PDF, and PDF helps up-and-coming professionals accelerate their performance in the modern workplace. I hope you will enjoy this program. Our guest today is Jack Milligan. Jack has been a friend of mine for many years. He has an impressive background in human resources, both in a corporate role and in a consulting role, specifically in outplacement. Jack formed his own HR consulting firm, Letters Milligan & Associates, and recently sold the company successfully. In 2002, he received the Professional Excellence Award at the Arizona Sherm State Council. And in 2016, he received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the same organization. For 22 years, Jack taught HR professionals to obtain their official HR certification. And that is why I like to refer to him as the guru of human resources. Welcome, Jack. How are you?
Siebe, thank you. It's always a pleasure. And I wish my mom was still around to hear that introduction. I do. Thank you.
Well, the guru of HR, you truly have an amazing background. And we are very grateful that you are joining us today to learn from your experience over time. Before we get into the 10 lessons learned, I am curious, Jack, has there been a lesson that you learned early in your career, a business lesson that perhaps you can share with us?
Well, interesting you ask. Since we're talking to up-and-coming professionals, I can remember one of the most indelible impressions that I experienced was really as a senior in high school in beautiful downtown Akron, Ohio, where my school counselor had a bulletin board where companies locally could apply, you know, for jobs for part-time students. And I applied for one of those and got the job. And the job was working for a company called Olson Electronics. And it was after school, so it was like 4 to 7:30 or 8 o'clock at night, 3 days a week. And my job, as it turns out, I was so happy to have it at the time, was minimum wage, of course, but and it was to a high school senior who was really in his first job. It was like I was going to be rolling in dough.
Sure.
But the job itself is what taught me a serious life lesson. My job was to, you know, I was surrounded by a basement full of electronic parts, you know, widgets and gizmos and gadgets and rheostats and, you know, semiconductor, all kinds of interesting electronics. And my job was to put together what was called a mystery box out of the catalog for Olson Electronics. People could order specific electronics, of course, but they could also get this mystery box. And you never knew what you were going to get. It's kind of like a box of chocolates.
Sure.
And so my job was to push this little cart around and take a few from this box and a few from that box and a few from another box and then package it all up and put a shipping label on it and send it out. And of course, the first week of doing that, I was really excited. The second week of doing that, I became, you know, this is a little repetitive and a wee bit boring. And the third week, I started looking around and realizing I was doing this in a dark basement. And in Akron, Ohio, in the wintertime, it gets dark early. And so there I was alone, pushing, there were other people in the building, but not in the basement. And so I'm just doing this repetitive circling, like, you know, going through a maze and putting these boxes together. And I think I lasted 3.5 or 4 weeks at that job, realizing, and this is the insight, it's like, I need human stimulation. I need to be around people. I need to be social in what I do. And that job just literally drove me crazy. And so I had to give it up and go find another one at that point. But
oh, I love it. I love it.
Really, you know, it says I can't do isolation. I can't do one of those individual contributor kind of jobs where you've got no other people around you. And so I just want to stir crazy.
I like it for different reasons, because, of course, I know you quite well, and I know you interacting with, well, over time, thousands of people, amazing numbers of people that you have worked with and counseled. You are, in that sense, very much an extrovert. You like people and people like you. I can safely say that. So I can see, if I think of that and your personality, to put you in the basement without other people, it could be interesting technology, right? Like you said, but that's not the place you want to be.
No,
but
no,
you have to experience that first,
right? And so the moral of that story, I guess, is look into yourself and understand, you know, what kind of environment you need, and kind of subscript that with, that's got to have some kind of checklist as you move into a real career kind of position. So I was able to apply that pretty much the rest of my normal natural career to, you know, is this job going to have some of those, be able to check off some of those boxes that has to do with human interaction?
It kind of reminds me, Jack, of when I applied for my first serious job after graduating from the university, and I went back to my home country in the Netherlands. I had studied in the United States, and I thought, you know, I don't want to work for a bank, but the first opportunity was a bank that showed interest. And in my mind, I thought, I want to get used to interviewing back in my home country, go through that process. Let's start with a job where I'm not interested, because that way I just get that experience and then I can move on and become serious. Well, the reality was they offered me a job, and I had a great time working for Citibank in Amsterdam at the time. Something I would have never expected. And I spent a number of years, as you know, in international corporate banking.
Right.
It was never my plan. In your case, it was the reverse. You realize this is not what I want to do, but it helps you then perhaps steer your career in the right direction.
Oh, yeah. I headed right towards human resources work. So.
Absolutely. Well, that's an interesting story to start with. Looking at your 10 lessons, the first one, I'm already curious, your thoughts, live a goal-directed life of accomplishments. What do you mean with that?
Well, I'm a firm believer in the notion that people who set goals tend to accomplish more. Being a goal-directed person kind of follows logically that if you establish goals for yourself and for your performance and for your career in a number of well-known areas, the major areas of your life, you will in fact enjoy life more, you will accomplish more, and I believe your life will be richer because of it. And I suggest six major areas all need at least one written goal at a time: personal, professional, family, financial, spiritual, and community. Those six areas, I think, all deserve good analytic thought and the discipline to actually cast it in writing. And I think those should be SMART goals. You know, that's an acronym, of course, stands for specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-based. SMART goals tend to, by themselves, define the kinds of things that you have to get done in order to say, I can check that one off and move on to the next one. But if we can get goals, a single goal at least, in each one of those areas, what it does is allow us to make some informed decisions about our time, how we spend our time. Mm-hmm. And in pursuit of those goals, or, you know, in going bowling, or, you know, trying, you know, some reading, a casual reading, or do I apply this particular thing? The most important commodity any of us have is time. I guarantee you it's limited. It is finite. And while at some points of your life, it feels like it's going to go on forever, it doesn't. And at some point you do run out of it.
How do you know if a goal is SMART?
Well, it has to pass those tests, you know. The acronym SMART all stands for a particular test for your goal. So is it a specific goal? Is it in fact measurable? Is it achievable in the first place? And is it relevant to what you are trying to do and accomplish, generally speaking? And lastly, you put a time base on it. I'm going to do this by a certain date. And of course, sub plans all have to have those same kinds of things. What are you going to get done by what date? And you know, so you constantly put the M back in, the measurable part.
I like it. I mean, I strongly believe in setting goals, and on a weekly basis, I write lists of things I need to do. And I've been doing it for many years. And as I sometimes tell people, I write lists of lists because I have so many lists, and I do keep track of them, right? Because it's they're all, let's say, relevant, smart in that sense. There you go.
This kind of thing. You know,
that's it.
I keep that right in front of me at all times and work down through the checkboxes. And that's been proven by the psychologists after study that shows that highly productive people just tend to be goal oriented. So is it cause or is it effect? You know, one goes in hand with another.
Yeah.
Highly productive people are generally goal oriented.
I like it. Yep, I agree. The second lesson, Jack, is in your professional life, understand your industry.
Well, in a professional life, I believe it, whatever you are doing, whatever career you pursue, that you look around you and understand what industry that you are in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in your professional life, I think it's very beneficial that you take the time to figure out what industry is, understand that industry, study that industry, and you do that primarily by studying your competition. So understanding your industry leads to studying your competition. And then lastly, this is one of those number of these that cheat and have three things actually, is understand where the money comes from. You know, what's the cash flow of the organization?
Follow the money.
Follow the money, you bet. Now, I don't care whether you're a butcher or a baker or a candlestick maker, those three things will apply to any effort you are putting your heart and soul into in terms of your career. Understand the industry, understand your competition, and know where the money comes from and where it goes. It really doesn't matter what you do. As an HR guy, I certainly wasn't responsible for some of those things as my primary goal set in the human resources field. But it really gave me a leg up when I could have a conversation with any of the senior managers in our organizations because I understood the competition and what they were going through. And I understood where we were vis-a-vis that competition. And so, you know, it's like the higher you go in any organization, the more you're going to be responsible for having the right strategic direction and magnetic north in the right place. And those are three key secrets, I believe. Understand your industry, understand your competition, and know where the money comes from.
It also helps, I think, once you understand that, to position your own value proposition, right? What can you add to an organization? What do you have to contribute? And it is very helpful when you are in a job search to really understand that company, but also the industry, its competitors. And that is, I think, very helpful. It's not just applying for a job, you are applying for that specific job. And if you can demonstrate that you understand to a great extent what is happening, you may not know all the details, of course, but that can really make a positive influence on someone that is looking to hire someone. You say, this person can contribute because he or she is already aware and understands the issues that we're dealing with.
Absolutely. You make good points, all of them. And so I think we're in agreement on all those.
Well, let's move on to number three.
Let's move on.
If and when you have people reporting to you, hire them with care, treat them with honor, and absolutely positively, do your performance reviews on time.
Again, a threefer under a category of just one of the 10 things. It's highly likely that, and I'll come back to this a little bit later on, it's highly likely that in your career, you know, you're going to get good managers, you're going to get mediocre managers, you're going to get bad managers. But whenever you yourself find you're moving into a supervisory kind of position, one of the hardest career changes individuals can make is moving into a supervisory position from being one of the boys or girls. Mm-hmm. And so you have to separate yourself from the group and become a leader, become a supervisor. The second biggest, I think, changes is when you move the next step up, when you start supervising other supervisors or managers. So each step up, you get a little bit further away from your core expertise, whatever you started as in an organization, and you become more and more focused on your ability to get things done through people.
I like it.
And so when you get into one of those kinds of positions, I think hiring right in the first place, you know, is one of the keys to your success. Hire them with care. Also, you know, treat them with great respect. Employees, particularly highly productive employees, need feedback, and that leads to the third fudge factor here in this particular one, and that is do your reviews on time. Having a career in human resources, I can't tell you how many organizations, how many companies seem to have a little cancer going on in their midst because the people in charge of people aren't really given those people the feedback that they need in a timely fashion. I've been in organization after organization where getting performance reviews, the feedback, that synapse that actually happens between a boss and an employee is one of the single most important communication sessions that employees ever have. And supervisors aren't comfortable with doing it by and large.
And why is that? Why are they not comfortable sometimes doing that?
Well, I think the number one key to answer your question is organizations themselves have to hold their people managers accountable for doing people management. And there is no more single important milestone than the semi-annual or the annual review. Of course, there shouldn't ever be any surprises in those documented performance analysis. The real key to supervision is daily communication and, you know, never letting a surprise show up that you haven't already discussed with the individual. But a lot of supervisors just aren't comfortable with doing that kind of rating of another human being. And that's the problem. That's a management problem, because if we're going to select people to be in those positions, we need to give them the tools to do the job.
Is there perhaps an expectation, wrongly perhaps, that if you do well in a review, you can expect that your compensation will go up, or that if you do not do well, that your job may be on the line?
Well, you know, You bring up a good point, Steve, but there's a whole lot written and there's a whole lot of discussion going on about pay for performance. And the fundamental tenet of pay for performance, if you do a good job, you'll get paid more.
Yeah.
And you'll go up the line.
Yeah.
But here lately, a lot of organizations have decided to disconnect the performance review with the actual economic aspect of it. I just had my 50th year in human resources work. Organizations that I've worked with on, like you, four different continents have always kind of gone back and forth on this issue.
Yeah.
But either way you look at it, whether it's connected directly, where if you're rated a 5, you're going to get 10%. If you're rated a 4, you're going to get 7%. Those kinds of absolutes. Sometimes when some organizations are disconnected completely, but the conversation between the employee and the supervisor has to happen. It has to happen on a regular basis. And whether it's connected or disconnected, the supervisor has to communicate the reasons for that.
I was going to say,
in a way that they will understand.
The transparency will hopefully make that clear. The next lesson is be a lifelong learner. Listen well, and whenever possible, be a developer of human talent. Sounds good. Is that easy?
That's another threefer hidden under the, you know, the number four here. A lifelong learner. You know, most of the folks we're probably talking to, Siba, are recent college grads, or perhaps even, you know, about to be a college grad. And one of the things that we tend to celebrate is, boy, I'm glad I'm done with all that learning. and now I'm going to go apply it, you know. But the truth is that, you know, the half-life of a baccalaureate education is 3 to 5 years, depending upon how technical you are.
Yeah.
And you have to keep up with your profession. You have to keep up with what's happening in, you know, as the educational bottom bar keeps moving upwards, that you are staying up with that. And so a lifelong learner is what it's going to take. So celebrate the notion that you've got your undergraduate, you've got your graduate degree, or even your postgraduate degree, but realize there's nothing more passe than a 20-year-old baccalaureate degree. It's old, tired iron.
Yep.
You need to stay in the learning phase. So the second part of that is listen well. Listening has a great deal to do with trust in an organization and the fact that you are soliciting information from those who work around you and certainly those who work for you. But whenever possible, translate all of that listening into being a developer of human talent. There's, to me, after a long career, not very many greater thrills than hearing from people who used to report to me that have now risen to senior levels in organizations. And, you know, we stay in touch and we talk occasionally. And just knowing that developmental experience with them put them on some kind of track that they valued and they stay in touch. And I'm glad to reciprocate that because it's a thrill for me to have, I think, about 18 to 20 senior vice presidents in organizations spread around the globe who used to be in my department.
Wow. Wow. It's a very important point, and it's definitely a lesson that I'm still learning, I feel. I do remember when I started out in executive search, talking to candidates on the phone, and I would always prefer to see the people or meet them in person. And my boss said, well, you will, he told me, and again, it's a lesson learned for me, that when you listen, don't see the person. You actually pick up, as he put it, a certain rhythm in the person's voice. And boy, looking back over 20 years, I completely agree with that. And yeah. With that, the importance of listening, it's not only showing respect, but you pick up where that person is coming from. And that is obviously, as a manager, is critically important. It's not to convince that person one way or the other. It's to listen to him or her and to get that information and perhaps say, well, we need to give you more information so you can adjust your opinion or your thoughts, or, wow, you're on the right track. This is exactly what we're looking for. So okay. It's an important point. It seems simple, right? Stay right. Humble. It's a very important lesson to learn.
Well, that's the next one coming up, right? We're stressing staying humble, maintaining a servant mentality, and remembering to say thank you. That's my number 5 on your list there. And staying humble, you mentioned the magic words and kind of a great segue into this one, that no matter how much you think you know, there's probably enough room around the things that you really don't know quite yet to fill a boxcar or two. And so staying humble kind of goes along with this next one about maintain a servant mentality.
Yes.
Realize that you, particularly as a supervisor of other people, your primary job is to develop those people and knock down the barriers to them producing the maximum that they can, and otherwise just stay out of the way.
Absolutely.
And so that kind of goes along with, you know, the whole notion of servant mentality. And lastly, under this one, another 3-4, of course, stay humble, maintain a servant mentality, and never forget to say thank you.
Yes.
Those two words are very, very, very important, and it shows an appreciation for a contribution from another human being that you value. It's easy to translate that to, you know, that person is of value as well. And along that same theme, you know, all these things that you wanted me to put together, this list of mine of 10 things, it's really probably 36. But, you know, frequently they come in threes because they tend to be along the same tree and reinforce one another. It kind of leads to that, our next one, right?
Exactly. Admit your mistakes, be reliably honest, and promote trust. another threesome.
You know, admitting your mistakes, I think it kind of goes back to the supervisory treatment of people with care and honor, is you want to work as an employee, you want to work in an environment where you're going to grow and you're going to learn. And the good supervisors that you get to work for will not only tolerate you pushing the envelope, they will, in fact, encourage you to push the envelope.
Yeah.
The knowledge being, it's how you're going to learn. And learning by error is a very effective way of learning. For heaven's sake, don't make the same mistake twice. Learn from it. But by all means, those who are pushing the umbrella out, those that are pushing the barriers out, are people who are knocking on the limits of that. And creating an environment within a supervisor-subordinate relationship where that subordinate understands that it's okay for me to make a mistake. I want to own up to it. I want to talk about it, maybe in group or team fashion. I want to share the learning that I have made with others so that it kind of multiplies that way. But the expectation is that I will be pushing that envelope enough so that I will, in fact, make a few mistakes.
Yeah.
What that leads to in terms of admitting your mistakes is, becoming known in your peer group and throughout all of those areas of your life that you are a reliable, honest person. That you're going to take accountability for what you do and for what you don't do sometimes. And that, being reliably honest is kind of like a modifier of it. I'm not just a little bit honest or I'm a whole lot honest. I am reliably, contemporaneously honest.
Now, some people, Jack, may say that, admitting mistakes is a sign of weakness.
Well, those people probably don't admit many of their mistakes. That certainly is an attitude that can be held by a few people. But I think the world has taught us, and certainly my career has taught me, that it's best in all this servant mentality, being humble, telling the truth, kind of inner magnetic north, the direction of your behavior ought to be towards all of these things that we're talking about. Because what it does is it helps you grow overall and make this reliably honest impression upon your peers. And it's what we need in the world. And it's one of the things that we need in order to develop people.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. Fully agree. It's just that there are people, as we both know, that would perceive it differently. And indeed, those people perhaps may not reach their ultimate potential because, well, they make mistakes, but they won't admit it.
Well, I'd say don't worry about it.
That's it.
It's kind of like throughout your career, you're going to have some good and bad bosses. You can learn from each one of them.
Absolutely.
And so when we get to my very last one of the 10, we'll talk some more about this, but just the whole notion of being around trustworthy people, and that's the end of this one, those kinds of behaviors will promote trust.
Yeah.
And trust, in my opinion, is probably one of the most important but elusive commodities of the relationship between people and trust in an organization. I've been in lots of HR organizations where trust was absent in the organization, in the human resource department, and you can't really get much done. You don't get much traction if the overall reputation of you or your department is one that is not trustworthy.
Very important. And trust, of course, connects to integrity. And if there's no trust and no integrity, that's a bad situation to have for everyone involved.
Yeah, see, but I think one leads to the other. They're kind of synonymous,
Yeah.
And I think integrity, it's really promises made, promises kept. And as long as your ratio of promises made, promises kept is close to one, you're going to be building this trust. You're going to be building this reliability kind of thing that we're talking about.
Very important. Lesson number 7, again, prepare, anticipate, think.
Three things. Prepare, anticipate, think. So many times we're so busy, that we think, well, I'm just going to have to do some shortcuts here and fake it till I make it, that kind of thing. And so many careers are lost when they get into that kind of mentality. Mm-hmm. One of the single most important career lessons I ever learned was the notion that preparation is probably the single most important part of execution. Preparation is planning. Yeah. Preparation is thinking it through. It's having a vision. It's identifying where you think you need to go with this, where the solution is. Preparation is everything that goes into the research of it. But also, once you are as prepared as you can possibly be, recognizing we deal in a world of ambiguity, you're not going to get all the information that you want to make decisions many times. And so the secondary part of that is anticipate what could go wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I've developed a pretty good plan here, but what are the weaknesses in it?
Yeah.
Anticipate pushback.
Yeah.
Anticipate other opinions about what your planning and preparation has done for you. Those two things, great preparation and anticipation of where your pushbacks are going to come from, allow you to succeed in business case management, selling an idea, selling yourself. And a lot of people just don't spend anywhere near enough time in those two gears. And the third gear is think. The underlying reality of in order to prepare, in order to anticipate what it is time, that elusive quality of time, that finite thing we've all got just this limited amount of, that we spend some of that treasure. And the notion of, for heaven's sakes, just think it through. It used to be in the old days, you know, it was the IBM. It was in every IBM building. It was on every IBM business card.
Yes.
You know, is think. It's just that one word, think. And if you will do that and prepare and anticipate where things might go wrong, I think there's no denying your success.
True wisdom. Thank you. Good point. Lesson number 8, communicate with crystal clarity what you want and expect, and it tends to happen.
Yes. Yes. That's my belief. You know, one of the greatest falsehoods, Siva, about corporate communications, about any kind of communication, mm-hmm. is the expectation that has actually happened. Frequently, it hasn't happened. You tried. Yeah. And it didn't get across.
Yeah.
And so when I say communicate with crystal clarity, that implies that you also, you know, anticipate where the weaknesses of the communication might be, and that you ask your audience to say, now tell me what you just heard me say, in whatever fashion you choose to say that in, what you want whomever you're communicating with to replay what they heard back to you so you can tell if it's a match. And if indeed it's a match, then great, you've passed the test of communication. But frequently they will be a little off. And so zeroing in on that is the art of the crystal part of crystal clarity.
Is that something, Jack, that you also experienced in the Army, in the armed services?
Yeah. Well, you were in the Army too.
Yes.
Countries, but we're both in an Army. And the Army way was, which is, you know, repetition.
Exactly.
Repetition is going to become what they call rote. And so what you're doing is really creating reflexive kinds of things and to fit certain situations. And yeah, in the military, you know, the right way, the wrong way, and the military way is really, just. It's done that way so that you kind of automatically respond in certain situations. The meaning is the same across many barriers so that you will do the right thing at the right time.
Yeah. And there is something, you know, when you coach people, when I coach people, where you talk about brain muscle, you can train your brain. And the simple comparison is when you go through traffic and the traffic light is green and it goes to yellow and red, it's not that you say, gee, what just happened there, right? You may be listening to the radio or in our conversation with a passenger, you stop the car or you start driving. And I think that's part of training your brain and repetition typically requires that, and very useful. And I think once you have your brain muscle developed, things that could be difficult to deal with become much easier. You're already visualizing, you're already showing that film in front of you of how you plan to do it. I think that's very helpful.
It's a good point, Siva, that you make. I think, you know, the flip side of the communicate with crystal clarity coin is that you come back to test whether or not the results you expected are the results that you got.
Yeah.
So the flip side of crystal clarity is, you know, evaluation and accountability. You really do learn that the more trouble that you take with making certain that you have in fact communicated, you know, that it has actually occurred, that it has happened.
Yes.
Is that you get the kind of results that you expect. And so, and that kind of leads to number 9.
Well, yeah. And I feel that I need to make sure I'm in good shape because it says, shine your shoes.
That's how I get away with multiple things all rolled into one thing, right?
Shine your shoes.
Shine your shoes is really my idea of being emblematic of taking care of yourself.
Appearance sets the tone.
Yeah, and my dad drilled into me, and you and I both got it drilled into us again in the Army, is that shining your shoes is emblematic of a well-organized approach to where you are and what you do. It's taking pride as well in your appearance. It's leading a well-organized existence. Shine your shoes is all of these things rolled into take the time to make certain that you are appropriate in your presentation, in your preparation, in all of these things we've talked about, mm-hmm. and take pride in. Nothing builds confidence, Siva, like the preparation that we've talked about.
Yeah.
When you are well prepared, you perform better.
And that includes indeed shining your shoes or being dressed appropriately,
right?
Part of the preparation. And obviously once you do that, you don't have to think about it. It's taken care of.
Right. It just lifts a lot of weight off your shoulders if you've done the right preparation, the right planning that allows you the time to make certain that the details are in the right place. You can't anticipate everything, but what a comfort it is when you have an argument prepared for something that is now pushing back on you that you have anticipated.
Yes, yes.
You know, so, yeah, and you know, just take some pride in how you put the whole package together, including yourself.
I like it, and you bring it down to shine your shoes, but that's a very good, deeper meaning to it. Lesson number 10, you have trouble with your boss, you lose. Wow.
Wow.
No hope. No hope left if you have trouble.
You either got to, you know, it sounds harsh, but the truth is you either fix it or leave. You have trouble with boss, like I mentioned earlier a couple of times, you're going to have good bosses, you're going to have mediocre bosses, and you're going to have bad bosses. And one of the most troublesome times you will find yourself in is when you get a mediocre or a bad boss. But there's still learnings that can happen. There's still ways for you to grow as an individual, as a boss, a future boss, as a potential supervisor, wherever that, by just observing and watching the bosses that you are dealt through your career.
Yeah.
And so just because you're working for a bad boss doesn't mean there can't be some learnings there. There definitely will be. But your career is too short. There is not enough time on this planet in our lives to spend too much time working for a bad boss.
Basically, the clock is ticking, right?
The clock is ticking, and you want to make certain that you maximize your learnings whenever possible. And while you will have a learning from a bad boss, it won't be as enriched a learning as if you're working for the upper 10% of good bosses. So if you have trouble with boss, one way or the other, you're losing. And so when I say fix it or leave, you know, fix it. There's zillions of examples where there's been disagreements. I'm not talking about those kinds of situations between you and your boss about substantive, you know, differences of opinion or approach. And, you know, you need to work those out as they happen and go along with it. But I'm talking about the overall cumulative quality of the supervisor that you're trying to learn from. And if that's not where it needs to be, if that's not where it should be, then you need to move on. You need to get yourself another boss.
It's a very important point. And I think of that when our clients are recruiting candidates, they will look at, can the person do the job? Will they love the job? Do they have passion for it? And then the third one, sort of meant as a joke, but relevant nevertheless, can we quote unquote, quote, tolerate working with that individual? Does it click? And I think it's fair to say, if there is a candidate and you really like that candidate, chances are, and perhaps he or she doesn't have all the qualifications, but you may say, we like this person. And well, we can provide certain, you know, assistance so that he or she can do well. At the same time, if the person has the skills and the experience, but it doesn't really click well, chances are you're not even going to hire that person because it doesn't seem like a good cultural fit or personality fit. Very relevant.
Well, I agree. I think what you're talking about, Siva, is first of all competencies and second of all chemistry.
Yes, exactly.
And the single most important aspect of hiring is making certain that the individual that you are hiring with care turns out to be the person who brings the competencies that you think you're getting to the actual job.
Yes.
Chemistry, on the other hand, is, it's kind of a scientific term to apply to a non-scientific analysis of the bubbling, crackling cauldron of all of these personalities that go into the workforce, and do they all actually fit? And more importantly, is do they fit well enough to maximize the business opportunity presented to that team at any point in time?
Yeah.
And that is a much more elusive assessment, and it changes all the time. So much of chemistry is based upon mood and moods are very, very short-term kinds of situations, but
well,
you got to have the competencies.
I have to ask you another question. You shared 10 lessons, but just what you said, it can change the mood. Jack, are there any lessons in your life, in your career, that you have unlearned?
Oh, thank you. That's an interesting question.
Yes.
I'm sure there's lots of them, but the one that comes to mind really kind of shot all kinds of holes in my parachute. Because throughout my career, I always wanted to be a corporate vice president of human resources. And I worked hard and diligently over lots of years and finally actually became a corporate vice president of human resources. New York Stock Exchange listed publicly held corporation, billion-dollar global kind of.
Very successful.
Yeah.
Quote unquote, very successful.
Worst job I ever had. And I was so in pursuit of that in each measured step I took in my career, with that being the ultimate goal in mind, that I guess I'd call it, be very careful about what you wish for. And I spent 2.5 years in that job on the 19th floor of a Los Angeles high rise, Terra Not So Firma, in a building built on ball bearings, only to find out that the most fun and value that I had in my whole career is with, I was really one or two steps lower than that. And, I was at a plant level somewhere where we had 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 employees, and I had a budget and I had a staff and I had, colleagues and I had conflict and I had, all the kinds of things that go with having an organization around you. To 9 other executives on the upper floors of a high-class office building where nothing important is really happening. I had to spend most of my time out in the field with the individual operations to feel like I was actually contributing any value. Because back at headquarters, it was like negotiating between two senior-level vice presidents about why one has a thicker carpeting than the other. It was just nonsense. And And so be careful of what you wish for is the moral of that story.
This is so interesting because I had to think about what you mentioned early on about your first job somewhere in the basement working by yourself. And you thought that's not the kind of job. Now, so many years further, you are a senior vice president of a major corporation. And yes, you are dealing with people, but wait a minute. It doesn't really have much depth to it. And if I think of it, I don't know if you ever counted the number of people that you have counseled, but I imagine we're talking more than 10,000, perhaps more than 20,000 individuals that you have guided and coached and counseled in your career. And obviously, I can see it on your face right now. That's something that you truly enjoyed.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up. I've published a book on negotiations technique, and I'm not plugging the book, but
what was the name of the book?
Thank you. Make More Money.
And it's on Amazon?
It is available on all the regular places, including Amazon. You bet.
I said it, not you. Yeah.
Anyway, my editor said, this is about, you're talking to people about negotiating their economic package when they join an organization. It's actually a book about career management, but a large part of it has to do, and the name is all about, I'm convinced that most people just simply leave too much money on the table when they join an organization. Most people don't ask. That's the subtitle to the book. So at any rate, the whole notion of what she was after was, how many people have you actually tendered offers?
Yeah.
And so I said, I have no idea. And she said, well, figure it out, because I want it for the gee whiz, some of the gee whiz statements that are going to go on the inside flap of the book. And so I went back to my very first job and kind of did an approximation of, and so it ended up, the number that I gave her was between 18 and 20,000 individuals that I've had a personal hand in their employment offer.
Think about that. Think about personal attention, not just a group, individuals. Mm-hmm.
Right. And the moral of that story was, you know, of all of the people who could negotiate their employment offers, only 10% actually do. The vast majority of people accept what is offered to them. And those that do negotiate, most of them do it wrong. So that's the secret of my book, is how do you get to be a 10%er and do it right?
Wow. So that's for lesson number 11.
Hey.
Read your book. Well, Jack, this has been phenomenal. Again, we know each other for many years, but I truly believe that we got wisdom for you. And I fully subscribe to the fact that you are known as the guru of human resources. I really appreciate that. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Siba.
And again, thank you, Jack. You have been listening to the international podcast of 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn. Produced by Robert Hossery and sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, PDF. PDF provides seminars, webinars, social media discussions, podcasts, and parties. For more information, please visit professionaldevelopmentforum.org. Thank you for listening, and please stay safe.